Good evening, everyone. It's 8:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time in New York City. This is Barry Gray in Studio 8, the old cracker box. And tonight, if you don't mind, on this Friday edition of the Coffee Clutch, I'll just wander from news item to show business item and maybe back again to a news item. This in addition to the Sunday night edition. That's alliterative. This in addition to the Sunday night edition, which is heard midnights until 2 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, and I do hope you'll tune in Sunday as well. Well, call me a Johnny-come-lately, call me what you will. Finally, I got around to it after about 5 weeks in mid-Manhattan. I went to see a tremendous show last night, something that made me think, and I'm sure that it's made thousands of New Yorkers mull the old gray matter over and over and over again. I saw the inimitable, all the incomparable and the very talented Lee J. Cobb in the stage play called Death of a Salesman. The story of Willie Loman hits home, I'll bet, in 98 cases out of 100. It probably grabs people right by the heartstrings and makes them think about something that must have happened in their own household at the approaching of old age by some member of the family. I got something a little bit different out of it, and I'd like to wander with it for a couple of seconds. Willie Loman is played by the great Lee J. Cobb, with whom I had the pleasure of speaking after the play, means to me a discussion of pensions. Oh, I know that Steele and the Ford Motor Company and everybody else in big business today is worried about pension plans and what's going to happen. See if you don't agree with this. Whether or not the Ford people or the Steele people, of course, Ford has already gone along with it, but whether or not the Steele people decide one day to pay pensions to the workers or not is, of course, their business. But here is the important thing, and the thing we must all remember. The country grows shorter each day as a result of its work-a-day week. I can remember very distinctly the days a few years ago when, was it Haywood Broun and people that followed in his great footsteps that used to talk about the 8-hour day and the 5-day week? And businessmen in that period said that Haywood Broun was crazy. I think that Gabriel Heater of our own mutual network in those days was a newspaper reporter, and he too went to big business and talked about the 8-hour day and the 5-day week, and big business told Gabe Heater that he was crazy. But the fact remains that as the years go on, from 28 to 35 and from 35 to 42 and now in the year 1949, more and more people are beginning to think of the fact that life is speeded up. And that where they used to work a 70-hour week, they now work a 40-hour week, and it's beginning to look as though it's one day going to be a 28-hour-a-week week. And with that comes the idea, too, that with life speeded up, they're looking for younger and still younger men, people that move a bit more quickly, with a bit more precision. And then you begin to think, what is to happen to the people who are 55 and 60 and 62 and 65, who have put in 25 and 30 and 35 years at their chosen jobs? I'm not saying at this point that it is the sole and complete duty of big business to support the people that have worked in their firms for 30 or 35 years. I just say that someone ought to do it. I'm in favor, of course, of Social Security plans, but Social Security at this late date is still a meager thing whereby you can hardly buy a pound of butter and a loaf of bread. Social Security is just a phrase given to a very weak-kneed plan that has not yet worked in a big way. I don't see how the people, particularly in some sections of the country with which I'm familiar, can get along on the $15 and $18 and $22 a week that they've been handed after doing their best for God and country for some 45 or 50 years. Retired railroad workers, retired steelmen, retired coal miners who have only one thing out of retirement, the nice memories that they can look back upon, but no cash in hand with which to buy the gilded duck. So much for pension plans. I might add, incidentally, to the people listening around the island, that I have a young bulb-nosed type who is running around in the studio with a camera, and this is not calculated to help the presentation of this broadcast at any moment. Go ahead. Thank you. There's a big story that comes out of the West Coast, and to those of you, ladies and gentlemen, that listen to this program on Sunday night, you, of course, heard the requiem that I felt so closely and dearly, the requiem to the late Buddy Clark. And if you've been reading the newspapers the last couple of days, you've noticed the items growing smaller and shorter and weaker type. And before the story becomes obliterated completely by the World Series or some other great and much closer and more important story, I'd like to spend a few words with it, if I may. The Buddy Clark story is a tragedy in that the accident should not have happened at any time. The pilot that flew the plane from Fresno, California, a town that's about halfway up the California coast between Los Angeles and San Francisco, the pilot that flew that plane from Fresno and tried to bring it into the Los Angeles airport, obviously, according to the CAA, late yesterday, had not taken the trouble to even investigate the possibility of being nearly out of gas. I might add that Fresno, California, by air, is no more than 200 air miles from Los Angeles, barely an hour's flight, and it seemed so tragic that such a short flight should have ended in such a catastrophe. Number one, the pilot did not examine the gas tank. That's obvious. Number two, the plane upon landing split in two, and this is where fate takes the upper hand. The plane, in splitting in two, threw its occupants from the airship. Four of them slid across the street, as did Buddy Clark. The four, however, came to rest upon the pavement. Buddy Clark, unfortunately, had his head smashed against a curb, and that's what did it. And then, too, I understand from reporters on the scene, and I've talked to a couple on the coast since then, I understand that in rushing Buddy Clark to the Georgia Street Receiving Hospital, they were treating him for just a fractured skull. They did not know, and of course they shouldn't have known, that Buddy Clark had been suffering from a very serious stomach condition for a good many years, and as a matter of fact, had just come out of the hospital recently as a result of an operation on a stomach ulcer. And that, too, created an internal hemorrhage which hastened his demise. There have been some vicious people that at no time in Buddy Clark's life, now in his death, wish to say unkind things about the late, great singer, and have hastened to add remarks up and down the main stem that would lead you to believe that Buddy Clark was not a nice guy in life and did not take care of his family in death. And I would like to straighten that out right now. The Clark family, I understand, will come into some $30,000 worth of insurance, all that he could possibly get with his ulcer condition, in addition to the fact that a house that is very large and mansion-like is completely paid for, and two, records that will go on and on and on for many years and pay them a handsome stipend for quite a good long time. Then, too, I think that we should all take hats off tonight to a wonderful little guy who is one of the vice presidents of the Columbia Recording Corporation. I'm speaking of Manny Sachs, the mentor and the fellow that's discovered people like Sinatra and Doris Day, yes, and Buddy Clark, too. And according to Manny Sachs, I understand that they're going to have a series of broadcasts each Sunday night in the appointed time, 10 p.m., in which the late Buddy Clark was to have been starred. Only in this case, it will be people such as Dinah Shore, Frank Sinatra, and it goes on and on. The list is strong and mighty, and all of the artists performing are foregoing their salary, the money to be given to the Clark family. It should roll up into quite a handsome ball of loot. I'll be back in a couple of moments. Here's a public service word.
Because WOR believes that an informed citizenry is just about the greatest safeguard a democracy has, and because we know that a radio station is in a unique position to help inform its listeners, we feel our news service to you is one of our most important activities. As a matter of fact, WOR devotes at least 4 hours a day of its airtime to news programs, accurate, concise, up-to-the-minute reports on the latest happenings in your home community, the nation, and the world. That's a lot of precious hours, and they are necessary in order that there will be at least one news broadcast every day to meet the need and convenience of every single listener. From 6:30 every weekday morning to 6:30 the next morning, there's a news program to suit every listener. The early morning riser, the farmer, the homemaker relaxing for a moment after getting her family off to school and office. For those who like to catch up on world events while eating dinner, and for those who want to hear the news just before they turn in at night. It's a pretty impressive array of time and reporters, and that's not even mentioning our commentary broadcasts, sportscasts, and weather reports. So to keep in tune with the times, keep tuned to WOR.
Thank you. You know, it's a funny thing about big business. Every once in a while, when they want to propagate a fund, a plan, or a discussion, they usually have a few millions of dollars to toss around and spend on newspaper advertising, radio advertising, word-of-mouth publicity, etc. I think it was President Truman a few months ago that pointed out in one of his Washington so-called fireside chats that the little guy of the United States cannot afford these very expensive procedures and cannot take large newspaper ads such as the A&P is currently doing or such as Big Steel is currently doing. They cannot ask the rest of the country for the things they want via the newspaper printed page or radio programs. It lies, as a matter of fact, within the realm of the commentator the man that sits at the microphone that feels strongly about these things to present the side, the other side, the little guy's side. And for that reason, I'd like to talk for a couple of seconds about socialized medicine and then wander into the Honolulu pineapple type strike and get with that for a minute or two. Down south, for the last 6 or 7 months, we've been doing a lot of talking about socialized medicine and finally come to the point where actually we shouldn't call it socialized medicine at all, but call it a national health insurance plan. National health insurance is one thing, and socialized medicine is quite another, and I'd like to explain the difference between the two. But first point out that the American Medical Association has already spent almost all of the $3.5 million that they had requested from their membership fund to fight the socialized medicinal plan as proposed by President Truman. They are fighting it tooth and nail and right down to the last inch. They don't want any part of it because they say it will bring about a socialist form of government. That, of course, is ridiculous and completely untrue because, contrary to the AMA's statement, socialized medicine is working, not well, but working in the British Isles. And this on the statements of many, many people that have recently returned and seem to know what they're talking about. However, I, as one citizen, if I may, am not particularly in favor of having the doctors and the dentists of the United States all work together for government's patients. I don't believe, as a matter of fact, that a doctor or a dentist worth his salt will ever refuse to wait for a couple of weeks for his money. You know, of course, this whole thing started when millions of Mrs. Joneses started talking about Dr. Smith down the street who wanted his money in advance. And they couldn't afford to give him his money in advance to treat Susie or Mike or Joe. And therefore, they rose up in arms and started to write letters to the President of the United States and the Congress. And they came up with a plan somewhat like the British Isles plan, whereby if you wanted to go to a doctor, you wouldn't have to pay the doctor. You'd just go and give him something like your Social Security number. And he, in turn, would send your bill to the United States government, and the United States government would pay that doctor. That means, of course, that everyone in the United States, man, woman, or child, could go to any doctor that they chose to. They could also go to any dentist that they cared to visit, and the dentists and the doctors would bill the United States government, and in turn, the government would collect it from the people by weekly taxes, somewhat like the Social Security deduction. Have I made myself clear? Have I? All right. Now, the AMA disagree with that plan completely. The American Medical Association is comprised of almost all of the doctors of the United States, and they say that, number one, it will start the patients of this country into becoming the biggest group of gold bricks the world has ever known. And they point out that in England, many thousands of Great Britain citizens have rushed to the doctors and dentists and gotten glasses that they really didn't need. They've gotten false plates that they really didn't need, both uppers and lowers. They've complained of various aches and pains that some of the doctors say were never really there. And according to the American Medical Association, it will turn us into a nation of hypochondriacs or gold bricks, guys that say they're sick but really aren't, just trying to keep from doing a day's work and earning a day's pay. That's their argument, and I'm being fair and giving both sides of it. The other side of the story is this, and this is President Truman's side. He says that some of the things that the AMA say are quite true, but the fact remains that 68 million people in the United States, and that's better than half or about half of the population currently, 68 million people in the United States cannot afford proper medical or dental care. And it's true, and I ask you to ask yourself, if you could afford any great layoff for a week or a month or a year, and still your family would be taken care of, and I'll venture to say the answer would be no, because very few of us, can afford any lengthy and serious illness such as TB, cancer, and the other great scourges of mankind. The president says that 68 million people are in this condition today, and he points out also that 325,000 people each year die needlessly as a result of lack of proper medical, yes, and dental care, too. These are the facts and the statements. And I'd like to propose a compromise, if I might. And I've been talking about this compromise for a good many months. I don't believe, first of all, and as I said earlier, that any doctor or dentist worth his salt will ever refuse to wait for his money.
What's your favorite radio program? Think carefully before you do business with a man who asks this question. You may be gypped with shoddy merchandise. Remember, a legitimate researcher never has anything to sell. When in doubt, check with your Better Business Bureau, 280 Broadway in New York City.
Thank you, and good evening again. A couple of brief seconds about the story that comes out of Honolulu tonight. I might add that I'm very happy that the strike has been settled between the Harry Bridges strikers and the Big Five or the Big Six of Honolulu. In all the time that I've been reading the story that's come out of Hawaii about the strike by the working men for higher wages in keeping with the wages that were in effect on the mainland of the United States, I have not yet read one word that explained why the men were striking. Of course, the newspapers pointed out that the men wanted more money. They didn't say, however, why they could not get more money under the old plan, you know, by doing their job properly. I should like to explain at this point that in the Hawaiian Islands for many, many years, and I mean many years, there have been five or six companies that have controlled all of the big business and small business of the Hawaiian Islands. If you worked for one of the five and you asked for more money and they fired you, the chances were 99 out of 100 that when you went to apply at company number 2, 3, 4, or 5, the word had already gotten around that you were not a nice fellow, that you wanted to be paid for your day's labor, and you were not hired. I think they call it a blacklist. No one can prove it, but the fact remains that for many years, if you worked for one company, and if you were fired for any reason at all, you never managed to work for any of the other 4 or 5. Begins to look like circumstantial evidence. Therefore, after many years, the only way it seemed that they could get the raise in pay that they desired was for all of them to walk out at once. There was much talk about how the islands were tied up, how food could not come in or food could and food couldn't get out, but the fact remained that the only weapon the little guys of the Hawaiian Islands had was to strike as they did, walk out in a body and ask for that 14 cents an hour more in pay, and they did get it. I might add, too, that the people that have been making the most noise about the longshoremen strike in the Hawaiian Islands are people that have never done any heavier work than just lifting up a pen and applying it to a piece of paper. It's always the people that stand back and talk disparagingly about the coal miners or about the musicians or about the people that pack pineapples, these people that stand back in their starched shirts and neat blue suits and discuss the guys that are doing heavy work and say they shouldn't be given that 7 cents an hour because they don't deserve it. These are the people, the ones that speak disparagingly, that have never done a day's work such as this is, nor have they ever experienced have they ever experienced the experience of watching a man come up from the pits of packing pineapple on a ship and doing all the other drudge jobs that must be done so that you and me may eat, huh? Oh, I know manual labor is the word. Thank you very much. One quick line before I get off this mic. I'm too amused by the story about a Stanley W. Omdahl, $50 a week bank teller, who yesterday clipped $9,900 from a Brooklyn bank and was picked up in Las Vegas, Nevada. The story goes on to say that he'd been with a bank for 5 years and showed a brilliant and bright future. And I want to know, if he did, how come he was only making $50 a week? Ladies and gentlemen, I give you tonight, before I leave, the picture of a good American, a fella that's hated and attacked by Westbrook Pegler and the Daily Worker all at the same time. This is Barry Gray, and thanks and good night.
This is the Mutual Broadcasting System.
Caught cold? Take laxative bromoquinine cold tablets. No other tablets taken for colds can promise greater relief from headache, fever, stopped-up nose. For some things, aspirin's fine, but for a nasty cold, take bromoquinine.
Hear the World Series exclusively on WOR. See it on WOR TV, Channel 9. WOR and WOR FM, New York.
Here's 5 minutes of the latest news brought to you by Johns Manville, producers of asbestos, the magic mineral, the great enemy of fire. Your reporter, Bill Henry.
Tonight's thumbnail summary on the World Series shows the New York Yankees with a 2-1 lead in games, thanks to today's 4-3 victory over the Brooklyn Dodgers. The rival pitchers again held the upper hand until the ninth inning, and at that point, the two teams scored more runs in one inning than in all the 26 previous innings put together. Brooklynites are talking to themselves tonight. It's mighty tough going when you get 2 home runs in the ninth inning and still can't win a close ball game. The case for the Navy was made clear by Admiral A.W. Radford, chief of the Pacific Fleet, today. He pulled no punches before the Congressional Committee, said he supports unification, but he believes safeguards are needed to prevent disastrous results during the transition period. He said he believed that vital decisions on highly technical defense matters are being made by civilians in the Defense Department without all the facts, many of them facts which only the Navy could supply. He characterized the Air Force B-36 bomber as a billion-dollar blunder, a 1941 airplane which would be a liability on defense of questionable efficiency on offense. Testimony will continue tomorrow, but naval morale is much higher tonight, and the proposed changes in the Unification Act, suggested this afternoon as a subject for discussion by Chairman Vinson, sounded as if the Navy had made considerable progress on the first day of the presentation of its case. On the foreign scene today, the Russians, as predicted, stepped in and set up a communist stooge government in East Germany. France is still looking for a new prime minister. Britain is all wrapped up in the proposed date for the all-important election, a date which will probably be set late next week after Foreign Minister Ernie Bevin returns from the United Nations meeting in New York.